sit back, relax, and take a ride with us on the Gunblog Variety Cast, episode 12. Cast. I'm your host Sean from NC Gunblog, and with me today is Adam from Guns Cars Tech Blog. How are you doing, Adam?
Still sleep deprived.
I'm starting to think maybe I should just record my intro and just play that. You know? It's the same intro every time, but you know we got to welcome our listeners back the same way. Want to ease them into how it's going to get weird. So let's go with the tactical dog and fitness report. 33.6 dog walking miles last week. I kind of slacked. But I did post a YouTube video of Dices playing two disc.
Oh, nice. So nice.
I found if I stand right in the middle of the little side yard, I throw one frisbee one direction. She comes running back. I tell her to drop it. She drops it at my feet, and I throw the other one, and she has a good time with that.
Good, good, good. So I wanted to talk to you about zoomies. Do you know what zoomies are?
Yeah, people in the Air Force.
No. With our dogs, so you and I have a very similar breeds. There's a thing that they will do, and you've probably seen Dices do this, where all of a sudden she just goes insane and runs around in circles.
Oh, we call that running like an idiot time.
When I started looking to get a Malinois, somebody said, "Oh yeah, well they do zoomies all the time." I'm like, "What is that?" And sure enough, I mean, so Casey will be 4 at the end of this month. That's tactical dog, and she was doing that all week this week. just out in the backyard, because we had a cold snap this week, and that, you know, makes the dogs a little bit more frisky. And so she's just, but yes, running like an idiot does sound pretty accurate.
Yeah, we call it running like an idiot time. I will come back from a 3-mile walk with the dog. I let her off her leash, and then I'll tell her she's free, and she'll take off. She'll run to the hallway, and she'll run down the hallway into what should be, I guess, the dining room. And 4-wheel drift, you know, rally car style, and then come galloping back up the hallway as fast as she can. And then she'll make the loop around the coffee table or around the couch, and she'll cut the turn and back down the hallway as fast as she can, hit the end of the hallway and 4-wheel drift again. And she'll just go back and forth a couple of times because that's what you do, I guess.
And I don't know about Dices, but Tactical Dog, it looks like it's almost involuntary. Like, she can't control it. Like, she can't help
control
herself.
The running?
No, like, she can't just stop running. She just has to keep going. Go, 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 go.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. She'll watch us. Our dog is a very submissive dog. She really wants us to be happy. And so she's looking for approval when she runs like an idiot. And it's like, well, go have a good time. It's funny. It entertains us. And so, you know, everybody's happy.
Yeah.
Well, now it's time for the blue collar prepping with that bratty kid sister, the gun blogosphere, Aaron.
Aaron wants to talk to us about water on the go.
Well, hey, Aaron, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing fine, Sean. How are you?
Doing pretty well. What do you got for us this week?
Last week, I talked about food for a bug-out bag or get-home bag, so this week, I'm going to talk about water, which is actually even more important than food. Problem with water, though, is that it's heavy, it's incompressible, and you need a gallon of it each day, and a gallon weighs 8 pounds. And of course, if you're active in a hot environment, you're going to need more. So since you can't easily carry a gallon of water with you, the logical solution, as far as I'm concerned, is to find a way to make found water drinkable.
Okay, how are you going to do that?
Well, the obvious solutions are boiling or pasteurizing water, and that's great, but it takes time and fuel. Bleach, like I talked about in the very first podcast, works really well, but not only does it lose its potency after a while, but it's awkward and kind of dangerous just to carry it in your bag if you've got it in a little small glass bottle with the dropper. So my advice for purifying water, especially if you're on the go, you're walking home, is to invest in filter straws or bottles.
Yeah, I think that's a really good distinction. The difference between if you're in a fixed location at your home where you can use bleach, where you can boil or pasteurize, but if you're moving and you've got that's a lot of equipment that you would have to carry, and at a certain point you're like, well, I could just carry a gallon of water and it'd be less weight.
Mm-hmm. And that's only good for one day. There are some people whose get-home bags, you know, their trek might take them more than a day. So what, now you're going to carry 16 pounds of water? I don't think so.
No.
So filters. I'm sure that there's someone listening to this who's thinking of the life straw.
Yeah, you stick the straw in, there you go, you got water.
Yeah, and that's great. As long as you've got a body of water like a stream or a swimming pool you can stick your straw into. Yeah, you're not going to stay by that water because that's called camping. I recommend one of two options, either a sports bottle with a built-in filter or a filter that you can attach to a bottle or a water bladder so that you can filter while you walk and you can drink as you get thirsty. Now, I recommend two products. They're both by a company called Sawyer. They've got an excellent reputation, and I have experience with them. My friend David Blackard on Blue Collar Prepping has experience with them. We all think they're great. Now, the first one is called the Sawyer Mini Water Filter, and it costs you about $20. It can filter 100,000 gallons.
That would get me home.
Yeah, and so you can use it like a straw, just like the life straw, stick it in the water, or you can attach it to the threads on a standard water bottle, so you can fill up your bottle and drink from there. It's also got an attachment for a hydration bladder. You attach it to the hose, so you could fill up your bladder with the questionable water, and you could filter it as you drink. Now, if you're willing to pay $16 more, you can get the Sawyer Personal Water Bottle. And it's like you think it is. It's one of these squeeze bottles like you do for sports, but it's got the filter attached to the straw. And this bad boy can filter up to 1 million gallons.
Okay, so that's going to get me and my wife and my dog basically all the way around the world.
Basically. And you can also hook it up to a bladder, a camelback, things like that. You don't have to pour the water into the bottle.
Okay. How small does it filter down to?
It has a 0.1 micron absolute filter, and it removes 99.9% of bacteria and protozoa.
That's pretty small.
Mm-hmm. And I think $20 to $36 is quite affordable, especially for something as important as water.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Aaron. It's good to talk to you, and I'll see you again next week.
Bye, Sean.
If you'd like to read more from Aaron, check out her blog, lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com. Felon's behaving badly. Brothers charged in Nash courthouse shooting. I would not be surprised if you saw this one on the news in your town.
I'm not sure that I did.
Yeah, the city of Nashville, North Carolina.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Much smaller town than Nashville,
yes.
Tennessee.
Yes.
Just a little bit smaller. Not nearly so famous in the music industry.
Right. But every now and then you're searching for something in Nashville and you'll get it in Nashville, North Carolina.
Yeah. It's a little dinky place. It's I like it. I go through there on a regular basis doing the job that I do, and I like the little town.
Hmm.
It's about, I'd say about 45 minutes from here.
About how many people?
Oh, I don't know. It's not that big, but it's a fairly rural place. Nash County authorities have charged two Rocky Mount brothers in connection with Tuesday's shooting at a courthouse that wounded two. Suspect 1, 31, of 1410 Cypress Street, stop by, say hi. I had to do it. I mean, of 1410 Cypress Street is charged with assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill. Suspect 1 surrendered to authorities Thursday morning. Investigators say he was the gunman in the shooting. Suspect 2, 36, was arrested late Wednesday in Raleigh and is also charged with two counts of assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill in the case. Shooting victims number 1 and victim number 2, were in stable condition Thursday at Vidant Medical Center in Greenville. Victim 1 was shot in the hand and leg, while victim 2 was shot in the back. Jenkins, which I believe was the sheriff, said victim 1 and 2 were targeted and knew their assailants.
Oh, okay. And this happened at a courthouse?
I believe it happened on the courthouse steps.
Wow.
Victim number 1, the one that was shot in the hand and the leg, ran and collapsed inside at the security desk, you know, where they have the metal detectors?
Yeah. Well, because one thing you know, if somebody's walking out of a courthouse, they're probably unarmed.
Well, I don't know if they were coming in or out. That wasn't discussed. But one thing, if I'm getting shot at, I'm pretty sure that those guys manning the security desk, they're all dressed in police-y type uniforms. Uh-huh. They've got guns. And I can just hide under a table while they shoot back.
There is that.
So score 1 for go for the safe zone. Victim number 2 apparently took off running around the block and was shot in the back as he went around the corner. Hard to say. There's not a lot of information being being released on what exactly happened, but apparently it was a huge deal. There was a lot of people in the courthouse, and, well, you know, it's a courthouse. There's always a lot of people there.
Yeah.
Even Nash County, which is, I mean, it's not that big a place. It's, it was a big deal. Suspect number 1, the younger brother, possession with intent to sell Schedule 6. We got sell Schedule 6. Possession with intent to sell Schedule 6.
Oh, so he's a drug dealer, I think.
Possession with intent to sell Schedule 6. More. Some more.
Jeez.
Even more. Possession with intent to sell Schedule 2. Schedule 2 is stuff like, I would guess that would be cocaine is 2.
Okay.
I think it's like PCP. Anything that has no medical value whatsoever is Schedule 1. But like, I think heroin falls into Schedule 2. It might be Schedule 1. I don't know. But, Schedule 6, of course, is marijuana. So this guy's a drug dealer.
All right. Find upstanding felon.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was the elder brother. That was suspect 2. Suspect 1, the younger brother, deliver cell Schedule 6. Also a drug dealer.
So, family business.
Yeah. Awesome. And victims number 1 and 2, which I can't keep straight. Victim number one, assault with a deadly weapon, inflicting serious injury, class E felony, possess schedule 3, class I felony, possession of a firearm by a minor, assault with a deadly weapon. This guy is just all kinds of, I mean, you know,
he's violent.
What a horrible thing that he, who's already assaulted with a deadly weapon, inflicted serious injury, happened to have somebody assault him with a deadly weapon and inflict serious injury on him.
Yeah.
And suspect number 2, maintain any place controlled substance. Possession of a firearm by a felon. False report to police radio. I assume that's by radio, not to the radio. I don't think that he went and addressed the radio and said, hey, let me give you this false police report. But in any case, driver's license revoked. Common law robbery.
Common law robbery.
Yeah, common law robbery. There's actually no law against robbery in North Carolina.
Okay.
Well, there doesn't need to be.
I guess not. If you got,
no, because it's recognized as a common law offense. If you use force or threat of force to take property from another person, that's well recognized to be a crime. I don't have to write a statute. It's a common law offense.
Actually, so that makes a lot of sense. Oh, okay. Yeah. That's very nice.
Breaking and entering vehicles, assault with a deadly weapon, possessing stolen goods, damage to property, assault with a deadly... What?
So,
I mean,
these guys,
I don't
want
to say
violent.
It couldn't happen to nicer guys, but couldn't happen to nicer guys.
Man.
So what we have here is two guys charged with shooting two other guys. All four of them were felons.
Nice.
And they have, you know, once again, proven my maxim. There's two places that honest people don't need to be anywhere near. In front of the cop shop. And in front of the courthouse. Just go to either one of them, what do you see? You see all kind of ne'er-do-wells hanging about. I mean, if I was a criminal, where's the one place I would not want to be? Anywhere near where cops were hanging out or where they might, you know, sentence me.
Yeah.
But no, that's where they all go. What was really funny about this, if there could be anything funny about a shooting in a courthouse, at a courthouse, not in the courthouse, but if there can be anything funny about it, is they snatched up one guy that they said was a suspect. And he turned out to have an ironclad alibi. He was elsewhere in the courthouse at the time.
There you go.
Apparently, he had the kind of alibi that was completely unimpeachable because the person giving him the alibi was wearing a black robe.
It's like, wait, no, no, no. That guy was in my courtroom.
Yep. answering other charges. Well, what was really, really, you know, what the part that just made me laugh out loud was there's an interview where they're talking to the sheriff as he announces this information that they've arrested the second assailant or the second suspect, whether he was an assailant or not, I don't know. And they ask him, so what about this other guy you falsely accused of being a suspect in the, and you know, now everybody Googles his name and they're going to come up with, I'm like, well, you know, if they just look in the Department of Corrections database, dude doesn't have a reputation to mess up.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously, the guy was a freaking felon and was up on charges that day.
There you go. Yeah. It's like, no, his alibi is that he was, you know, sitting in front of a judge answering other problems he had.
You know, he had his sister with him.
Yeah.
Hold this, you know, as character witness. Well, Nikki wants to talk to some foreign policy for grownups. Should the U.S. fund and support insurgents? Well, Nikki, every time we turn around, we hear yet another group of people saying, well, it's just blowback. It's the chickens coming home to roost. It's one more thing that it's America's fault and nobody else when somebody attacks us. Every time we help somebody out in their foreign policy issues, it seems to eventually come back to bite us in the behind in the end.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, the question becomes, is it worth it? Does supporting insurgent movements in other countries really work? Is it good for us? Do we continue to do it? For example, do we hope to topple the Assad regime by supporting the Syrian insurgents? What will we get in its place? It's hard to really gauge what's going to happen in the long term. So we need to really look at the history. And most people who study history, including my own husband, will tell you that no, this is bad. Supporting insurgent regimes in other countries against other governments that we don't like has been a fail all over history, over the 3 years. And to be fair to our president, he did actually order the CIA to take a look at it. And they came out with a report that basically said the same thing, that supporting insurgent regimes throughout history really has been overall a fail. I think we need to look at it in a more nuanced way. It really depends on what you call a fail.
If we've supported an insurgent group and they don't militarily topple the government that they were fighting against, then they failed, right?
Perhaps if our overarching goal is to topple a government and it doesn't quite happen, then perhaps, yes, we can say it's a fail. But fact of the matter is, there are nuances in between. We didn't really topple the government in Nicaragua by supporting the Contras, but at the same time, we kind of forced it to topple itself. The Sandinistas basically imploded, and what we did was help a democratic government along. So it depends on what you call a fail. A lot of people blame us for basically creating what we now know as Al-Qaeda, for creating the Frankenstein monster that is Osama bin Laden. We armed the Mujahideen against the Soviets back in Afghanistan back in the 80s. It was a foreign policy success at the time. They helped us get rid of the Soviets during the Cold War, and we used the insurgency very effectively as a proxy during the Cold War. So we obviously wanted to avoid this kind of superpower collision that really would have been a catastrophe during the Cold War and in the world. So instead, we fought these little proxy wars and armed these little insurgent movements and used them in conflicts as well. It made sense at the time, and frankly, that kind of signaled the end of the Soviets, and it toppled the Soviets. So in the short term, we accomplished our goal. It helped us get rid of the Soviets and win the Cold War, right?
I would trade an Al-Qaeda or other terrorist group like that for the Soviets any day of the week and twice on Sundays. We try to pretend that there were no terrorist groups when the Soviets were around. Well, the Soviets were funding them.
Well, sure, but also the kind of Islamic terrorism that we see and the kind of extremism that we see today was really kind of confined to their own little mad corner of the world. When some say that our policies had the longer term effect of creating this monster that we call Al-Qaeda and creating this global jihad, it's not necessarily paranoia. There is plenty of analysis that assesses the Mujahideen of yesterday have kind of morphed into this Al-Qaeda of today. there's a great article in Foreign Policy magazine that gives this very abbreviated history of Al-Qaeda and how they came about. While they were confined to their own little, you know, padded cell in the world, when they finally kicked the Soviets out of Afghanistan, this was a major victory for them. And all of a sudden, they went, ooh, viva la jihad! Let's try and spread our own little brand of madness all over worldwide. We can do this. And it kind of emboldened them to continue spreading and growing this hideous evil that has now become this global jihad that the extremists are waging. Literally, it's almost like the monster turned against Dr. Frankenstein.
We can't ignore the terrorist groups that existed at the time. Just because they were funded by the Soviets instead of self-sustaining or sustained by petrodollars now, doesn't mean that they didn't exist at the time. We had aircraft getting hijacked all the time. We had all kinds of nasty stuff happening. So it's not like we had no terrorism and now we have some terrorism.
No, absolutely not. And I don't think there's anybody that's saying that. Anybody who claims the United States is solely responsible for the rise of global terrorism really doesn't understand history. But at the same time, our actions do have consequences. And what we do in the present to advance our short-term foreign policy goals could, in fact, come back and bite us in our fourth point of contact. So we really need to be careful. It's my word of caution for the day. It's not to say that we can't reach our short-term goals by helping out those who might be on our side right now. It's just that we really, really need to be cautious about what those particular movements can become in the future.
All solutions are temporary.
Well, that is true. And I really actually appreciate the fact that the president is thinking about this very cautiously and thinking it through and ordering reports and historical studies, because this is not something that you just toss money at without thought.
As long as he doesn't make the perfect the enemy of the good.
I absolutely agree. And hopefully we won't create another monster.
All right, Nikki, it's good to talk to you. See you next week.
You bet. Take care.
Well, Nikki blogs at thelibertyzone.com. Strange gun laws. Wanted to talk about the Ohio hidden compartment law. This came up on Facebook. Somebody had this really awesome picture of, it was like the back of an SUV, and they had the foam down and the little cutouts, and you had a spot for an AR, for a bunch of magazines, and a spot for a handgun, and I was like, that's really nice.
That is pretty
nice. You know, I'd like to have something like that, you know, because it's North Carolina. You can carry a rifle in the back of your truck,
yep.
You know, no big deal.
Same thing in Tennessee.
And actually, in North Carolina, you can have it loaded in the back of your vehicle. It's not under your control, so if you feel comfortable with your AR, and it's floating firing pin right around the back of your car, you know, you could do that.
Yeah.
Don't do that.
I'd probably do it cruiser safe, you know.
Yeah.
Carry it, condition two?
Two, I think, yeah.
Magazine inserted, bolt down on an empty chamber, weapon on safe.
Right.
All you got to do is pull the charging handle, rotate the semi, and you're off to the races.
Yeah.
Well, somebody's like, oh, he could never do that in Pennsylvania because of the hidden compartment law. Somebody had to smack him down with that. Pennsylvania didn't pass a hidden compartment law, so there is no hidden compartment law in Pennsylvania. Clue number one. And then he goes into, well, in Ohio. Well, okay, we need to cover this, especially for anybody who listens in Ohio. The hidden compartment law in Ohio is very specific in what it says.
We should probably remind everybody that neither you nor I are lawyers.
But I do speak, read, and write English.
There you go.
Even the English that lawyers use. Ohio's hidden compartment law is 2923.241, hidden compartments in vehicles. Section A is a list of all the definitions. Section B is the meat of the law. No person shall knowingly design, build, construct, or fabricate a vehicle with a hidden compartment, or modify or alter any portion of a vehicle in order to create or add a hidden compartment with the intent to facilitate the unlawful concealment or transportation of a controlled substance.
So drugs.
You see how that works?
Yeah.
Yeah, drugs. Yeah. So if the intent was to put it, you know, your gun, is a gun a controlled substance? No. Not no. in the sense that they mean it. And what does it say for controlled substance?
Because they define that in Section A.
Has the same meaning as 37-1901. I guess I could open that up and read it. Controlled substance is a drug, compound, mixture, preparation, or substance included in Schedules 1 through 5. I get 1 through 5. I mean, was that not include 6, marijuana? Okay, interesting. Maybe it doesn't mean marijuana. That's odd.
Do they have a Schedule 6?
Yeah, marijuana is Schedule 6. That's what it is in North Carolina. I can't imagine it would be any different. It's a federal schedule. And what's especially interesting about the Ohio law, if you skip all the way down to I, this section does not apply to a box, safe, container, or other item added to the vehicle for the purpose of securing valuables, electronics, firearms, provided at the time of the discovery the box, safe, container, or other item added in the vehicle does not contain a controlled substance or the visible residue of a controlled substance. So guess what? Go ahead and put that foam lock box thing with your rifle in it, because the Ohio law says go ahead, knock yourself out. And the reason I bring this up is not so much that, you know, our Ohio listeners know that they can go ahead and put a lockbox for their gun in their car. It's so that all of our listeners get the very valuable bit of information when it comes to laws. When somebody gives you some BS information about what they think the law says, go read the law. It's posted online for your convenience. Don't let people, especially, you know, cops and gun shop commandos who are going to tell you all kinds of garbage about the law. Don't listen to them simply because they sound like they know what they're talking about. Go read the law. It's written right there. You can understand it. Trust me.
So Oddball, my co-blogger, his father is a lawyer up in Detroit, and he says, never, ever, 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 ever ask a cop what the law is.
Yeah. I wonder why.
Yeah. Do not do that.
Miguel would like to talk to us a little bit more about citizen self-defense and community self-defense in Peru and Thailand. So, Miguel, you sent me a very interesting picture out of Peru. Why don't you tell me a little bit about this?
This is an AP report from November the 3rd. The title is Three Village Defenders Reburied in Peru. Remember, it was a couple, 3 weeks ago, we went over the Shining Pass, the Peruvian guerrilla, and what happened, what they were doing back then in the 90s, and how eventually they were kicked out of the jungle, kicked out of the countryside, when the government allowed the villagers to arm themselves. Less than 2 years after that, Shining Path pretty much disappeared. It was crushed by the government because, you know, they don't survive well in urban areas.
Right, a great story of citizens defending themselves and defending their neighbors and defending their country. Oh, victory for the average Peruvians.
But the story in this one is sadly outrages me, because this is a story about three villagers. They defended the village. Not defended, they managed to distract the Shining Path group that was coming after the village. And three of them, a couple of them in their 20s and one guy in their 50s, told, you know, former military, they were soldiers at one time, faced Shining Path armed with nothing but rocks.
I want to read this. It was the second burial for the three members of the Citizen Self-Defense Force from this remote Andean village, who officials say died so that others might live. The men were slain June 14, 1990, investigators say, defending the 100 people who then inhabited, I can't say that, Hualhua?
Hualhua, yeah, you got it.
Hualhua, from an attack by Shining Path rebels with the only weapons at their disposal, rocks. The villagers escaped, and the bodies of the three men, their throats slit and their skulls crushed, were promptly buried by grateful neighbors to save them from feral dogs. Rocks.
Rocks.
They faced communist rebels bent on murdering them and their neighbors. They were military veterans, one of them 50, the other two 20 years old, and they were given rocks. That's all they had.
That's all they had.
And they weren't just killed in battle. No, their throats were slit and their skulls were crushed. They were captured, they were tortured, and they were murdered.
I mean, I'm trying to keep it in PG here, but it really, really upsets me that people had to go through this kind of crap because they were not allowed to have guns. They could not defend themselves. They were expected to face train guerrillas armed with AK-47s and God knows what else with rocks. Like it was pitting modern warfare versus Neanderthals. Of course they had to lose.
They had to know what the result was going to be. They had to go into this knowing that they were dead.
Yes.
It just, they needed to slow the bad people down long enough for 100 neighbors to run for safety.
This is the Thermopylae in the Andes, man.
Oh, and it's not even Thermopylae. In Thermopylae, the 300 Spartans had allies, and they had the same quality weapons as the people they were fighting.
I was talking about such a disparity of force. It's just amazing. I mean, the stones that these people had between their legs are just amazing.
This is basically the unarmed Andean version of Black Hawk Down.
Yeah, something like that.
Put us down, let us get out, we'll defend this guy, we know we're going to get killed. Here's a shiny ribbon for your family, that's all we can give you.
And probably they didn't even get that, you know. The thanks of other people they saved, but, you know, no recognition whatsoever. And maybe this little article, you know, nice little picture. It's just amazing. I mean, people, these idiots that banter for gun control, I mean, they don't understand that their mistakes, their stupidity is paid in blood, is paid in lives. This is a shining example. This is gun control.
This is gun control right here.
Of course, you know, it's like Shannon Watson, Michael Bloomberg, you know, that somebody it screams that they're real ugly in Facebook, and all of a sudden they have 5-6 big bodyguards with fully automatic weapons under their coats, okay, and, you know, looking ugly, and they have their armored freaking SUVs. Of course they're not going to feel it. They don't care. How the hell can they communicate? I would love to grab one of these two idiots and take them to Peru, take them to the graves when they were dugging out the bodies and shove them in their face and that. Tell them, this is freaking gun control. This is what happens.
Oh, but Miguel, they're going to say, Miguel, oh, but that was 1990. How can that possibly have any sort of application here in modern world here in 2014?
Oh, well, you know, thank God, the other thing that came onto my news feed was the Thailand. Apparently, I didn't know. I didn't know that one. Thailand is having issues with insurgents in the southern part of the country. So for once, history is repeating itself for the better. They're going to supply their people, their citizens, with 2,700 HMK-33 assault rifles.
Right, and this isn't like assault rifle, like, you know, defined by Shannon Watts. No, these are like fully automatic 5.56 HK. It's a version of the G3 rifle. It's a full-blown machine gun.
Yeah. Why? Because they gotta understand that the government only has so many soldiers at a disposition. They cannot be all the time. And they don't know the area. The people that live there know the area. They have a vested interest in defending their property, their lives, and they're gonna be much better than any guy who comes from any other part of the country to do a job and be placed there in a place in an area that doesn't know anybody, doesn't have any attachment. These people are going to be fierce.
I think the best statement here is what the colonel of the Internal Operations Security Command. They need weapons for self-defense. They can't fight with just wooden sticks. That's the truth of gun control. They can't fight with wooden sticks. We have to let them have weapons. Their lives are more important than the feelings of the anti-gunners.
Social engineering will freaking kill people. The problem is it doesn't kill the right ones.
That's right. If their stupidity killed them, nobody would care. But their stupidity is killing other people.
Exactly.
All right, Miguel. It was good to talk to you. See you next week.
See you next week.
Well, get more of Miguel Gonzalez daily at gunfreezone.net. Fun with headlines. What do you got for us?
Well, it was kind of a slow news week here, so I decided to cheat a little and went to Think Progress.
Which is in favor of neither.
Right. This is like shooting fish in a barrel. I mean, you can just pick anything, and they're all just, the headlines are not any sort of reality. So this one is, you can still eat this corgi in Pennsylvania thanks to the NRA. And of course, there's a picture of a corgi.
Not just a corgi, but a corgi puppy. That's not a full-grown corgi.
Oh, yes, it is a corgi.
It is about as cute as a corgi is ever going to get.
Right.
And corgis are fairly cute animals, and puppy corgis are, like, pretty ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a very cute dog.
So explain to me how it is that the NRA is responsible for the mass slaughter and eating of corgis in Pennsylvania.
Yes, apparently this is something that everyone does, like, on every Friday night. You just go out and eat corgi for dinner. No, actually, it's not at all. So what had happened was the Pennsylvania SPCA had proposed a separate law to make it illegal to eat dogs. I'm pretty sure that right now, if we went to Pennsylvania and fried up a corgi, we would go to jail for animal cruelty, and the jury would ask the judge to put us under the jail.
Abusing animals is second, third in line of horrible things that one can do. First, abusing children is the worst. Abusing women is second, and abusing animals is third. Until you get into actual, like, capital crimes, there's really not much worse you can do than abuse children, women, or dogs and cats.
And there's a lot of people who think that abusing a dog is actually worse than abusing a human.
I've met a lot of humans that I would say, well, they deserved it. Haven't met many dogs in that category, but okay.
That's true. So anyway, so the Pennsylvania SPCA proposed this law. Let's make it illegaler to eat dogs.
Actually, it says breeds, keeps, sells, or offers for sale or transfers a dog for the purposes of. It doesn't say eating. It's just this breeding and selling.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess there's that. So they had this, which is, I don't know that this is even a problem in Pennsylvania. Apparently, the SPCA thinks it is. And apparently, everything was going good. And then, and Sebastian over at PA Gun Blog, he knows all about this. They have pigeon shoots every year in Pennsylvania. It's apparently been a thing for, you know, many, many, many years, you know, 10s, 20s, I don't know how far back it goes.
Well, animal rights activists have been working to ban pigeon shoots for the past 27 years. So they've been trying to ban it for half my life.
So, yeah, yeah. So it's probably been going on since before Pennsylvania was a state. You know, just like you said, they try to ban it every year. And this was, you know, this was going. And so they did that nice little ploy where they said, okay, well, we're going to tack this. This thing that we've always been trying to get done, which is banning pigeon shoots, onto this bill that no one could ever possibly vote against, because who would want to eat a puppy? And the NRA said, yeah, you know how for the last 20-something years we've been scoring the pigeon shoot votes? We're still going to be doing that. And so the Pennsylvania legislators went, well, you know, I really like my A rating with the NRA, so no, I'm not.
Yeah, heading into
that.
An election.
Yeah. You know, technically it's right, but the NRA didn't go, no, we want to be able to eat puppies.
Well, Baron wants to talk to us about IP cameras, nanny cams, and how other people are watching what's going on in your house. On Tech Tips with the Baron. Baron, I was thinking about getting one of them nanny cams, or, you know, what do they call them, IP cameras, something like that, to put in my house. You know, maybe I want to be able to see what my dog's doing while I'm not at home. What do you think about doing something like that?
That is an awesome idea. Can you give me the password?
No, I'm not going to give you the password.
Well, how about you do this instead? Don't change the default one. Then you still have a password and, well, I know what it is.
I don't like that idea.
So when you go and buy most net devices, there's a default username and password for the device. And the best thing in the world is the fact that the majority of people don't bother to change them. And they don't bother to change them for a variety of reasons. Some don't think that it's necessary because, well, it's on my internal network and no one out on the internet should ever be able to see the camera. That's what my router firewall is for, right? The problem is that your firewall also probably supports something called Universal Plug and Play, otherwise known as UPnP. It allows a device to talk to it and say, hey, I need to get to the internet and I want things on the internet be able to come back and talk to me. And in so doing, they become crawlable to the internet. There have been a couple presentations at DEF CON on people who have created tools to actually go out and crawl the internet, finding IP cameras that are either completely unsecured, i.e. they just exist on the internet. They're streaming 24/7, 365, no password, no nothing. It is just fair game to go watch.
Wait, you're telling me that if I put one of these cameras in my house and I don't change the password, pretty much any idiot can log onto the internet and watch what's going on in my house?
That is very, very probably true, depending on the camera. It depends on the camera, but for the most part, yes, that is true.
That's creepy.
That is creepy, but it is creepy because of your own stupidity.
Okay, so what would I do?
What would you do? The first thing you do after you get it out of the box and hook it up to your network, and you go and log into the admin page, you go to the admin section for security that says, change password, and you change the freaking password. Change it to something. Remember how we talked a while ago about this whole randomly generated password of complexity that lives off in your KeePass database or LastPass or whatever it is? Yes, use a randomly generated password. No one needs to know that password. Not even you. Just store it in the database.
So how did this come to light?
There's actually a couple websites that actually crawl the web and aggregate open cameras so that they can be seen. There was actually a couple presentations at DEF CON where there was applications that could go and aggregate all this information for you. And most entertainingly is this doesn't just apply to IP cameras. This problem exists in well beyond your average consumer realm. My first real solid introduction to this problem was in industrial control systems, where we have to ship a item that's responsible for controlling a part of, say, the power system, and it has a default password in it because there's going to be passwords involved. So we need a password there, but the user has to be able to log into it initially. So it's a default password. Well, it ends up that the users wouldn't bother changing the password. They would leave them exactly the same so that all the techs would know what the password is, and hey, it's always the default password. Me, knowing nothing about the utility, all I'd have to do is go and hop over a fence into the substation, open up the door and go, oh, it's this particular brand of relay, and grab my laptop, plug it into the front, and then go and type in the default password and go, oh, look, I can start opening and closing breakers now.
That seems like a bad idea.
It is an unbelievably bad idea. It is an unbelievably horrible idea, and it is one of the things that grinds my gears.
All right, so important note, if I have anything that's connected to the internet in any way, shape, or form, I should make sure not to use the default password because everybody else knows what that password is and they'll just hack it.
Everybody knows what that password is, even if it isn't publicized. This is one of the other strong things that ticks me off. When you go and put a backdoor into some area and go, here's a default password for your administrative, well, not even administrative, but for service technicians coming in from, say, Comcast or whatever. Yeah, guess what? Eventually those passwords get leaked. They end up on the internet in some form someplace, and I can go find them and go, oh, here's the default password to give me root access on such and such router. Holy crap, not cool.
All right, I've changed the password on my router because, you know, everybody knows that, right?
Yes, do that.
How many people don't?
I don't want to think about how many people don't. I will tell you that it is more than the percentage that many of us want to admit, because I have on more than one occasion surfed around my neighborhood with my laptop, searching for access points that I can actually connect to, and then trying to log into the admin page. I have been successful on more than one occasion, and honestly, I should be batting zero on that front.
Yeah, and that one's one that everybody knows about. All right, Baron, it was good to talk to you. See you again next week.
See you again next week, Sean.
Well, Baron still blogs at the-minuteman.org.
These IP cams, you know, they've been around for a while, and I have a kind of a funny story. I was living in a town that shall remain nameless about 10 years ago, and I was, you know, driving through, and I noticed that they had these cameras on the light poles for traffic, and not only were they open to the internet, but they also, the control systems that were on there, that were pan and tilt.
Oh, I see where this is going.
Yeah, that were pan and tilt. Yeah, they had the default username and password on them. I may or may not have pointed all the cameras in opposite directions.
If it wasn't you, it was somebody.
It was maybe. It may have been. That I'm not sure. I'm going to go away now.
Oh, if you could only do that with those red light cams and the speed cams, especially.
Oh, yeah.
I've seen video of somebody like rolls up on a speed cam in a, I think it was like in England, and he did it in costume so nobody could tell who he was. and like spray painted it, threw a trash can over it. Yeah.
Well, you know, in Knoxville, we shoot them. there was a guy who shot one. Police pulled him over and they arrested him, and he actually got off because the police pulled him over and searched him because he was the only one in the area.
Not because they had any reasonable suspicion.
They're like, oh, we think we heard a gunshot and you're here, so we're going to search you. And they found the rifle, but he got off.
I don't know. Good thing he wasn't. Wasn't on his jury. Guilty of being awesome.
So, yeah, it actually never
even made
it.
Sorry, all I've got in my pocket is $10.
Oh, man. The local affiliate of the right-wing conspiracy, they totally, like, raise money for him and all that stuff. Yeah. I think he even wrote a book about it later.
Oh, that's hilarious. Was it called If I Did It?
Oh.
If the rifle fits, you must quit. Oh, no. Weird wants to talk to us about shouting fire in a crowded theater.
In this week in Anti-Gun Nuttery.
Well, hey, Weird, how are you doing today?
I'm doing really good.
So what's going on in your world?
So I've got a little nice, interesting thing to talk about. The anti-gunners seem to talk a lot about shouting fire in a crowded theater.
When's the last time a theater caught on fire? Who cares if you shout fire in a crowded theater? I've never understood that argument.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, back in the day, the original theatrical halls were lit by candlelight and they would frequently burn down. And then later on, when the early days of motion pictures, the film canisters were made of celluloid, which could be set on fire by the projector bulb. So some might say that might be archaic. But oddly enough, in 2003, very, very recently, there was a very famous fire called the Station Nightclub with the band Great White, and 100 people were killed in the fire.
Oh, I saw the video of that. That was horrendous.
It was horrible. But you know what? That's not the worst theater fire. There was, here in Boston, there was a nightclub called the Coconut Grove. And in 1942, 492 people died in a fire there.
490, that's a lot of people.
That's a lot of people. But it doesn't hold a candle, pardon the pun, to the Iroquois Theater fire, which is in Chicago. And 603 people died in 1903.
Right, so I guess what you're saying is fire in a crowded theater really was a serious issue.
It still is a serious issue.
If there's a fire, I want somebody to shout fire. I want them to let me know so that I can get out of there quickly.
Absolutely, and really, it's almost your duty. If you see a fire in a crowded venue, then it really is your duty to shout fire and make sure people know to get away from the danger. But the bigger issue is, what if you shout fire and there isn't a fire? There's a great example from 1913 in Calumet, Michigan. There was a place called the Italian Hall. They were having a birthday party, and someone decided to shout fire when there wasn't one. And 73 people died from being trampled to death trying to get out of a building that was not burning.
Didn't a bunch of people get trampled? I mean, it wasn't a fire issue, but the Who concert. I mean, basically, shout fire in a crowded Italian hall, and you have the Who disaster all over again.
Exactly. So really, the issue's not the shouting of fire, but it is the shouting of fire when there isn't a fire and therefore causing negligent death.
What does this have to do with guns? Why are the antis all over this?
The antis are trying to say that because shouting fire in a crowded theater is essentially a limitation to your First Amendment right, they're trying to say that that allows them to pretty much do whatever they want with banning guns because the Second Amendment can't be an absolute right. Except for, really, essentially what we're talking about here is negligent use of a right. So therefore, negligent use of firearms, which is already illegal.
Yeah, I guess it would be illegal to murder somebody, whether you murder them by causing other people to stomp them to death, or you murder them by pulling out a gun. It's just as illegal.
Exactly. What we're talking about is prior restraint. That's essentially the pre-publication censorship. So the idea is, you know, banning saying something because it might be bad, or in the case of guns, banning guns because of the crimes they might commit. What we're really saying is rights are not unlimited. They can be limited in certain ways. That means we can ban anything. Essentially what they're saying is they don't believe in rights. They're saying if a right isn't unlimited, it doesn't exist. And that is absolutely not the case.
I'm not allowed to shout fire falsely in a crowded theater. But what are they doing to physically prevent me from shouting fire in a theater?
Nothing.
Well, what they're saying actually is you shouldn't carry a gun in a theater because you might commit a crime with it.
Exactly. They're essentially just, I mean, it's not even about crime. They're just wanting to ban all guns, and this seems like an easy avenue for them. The idea of banning guns to prevent crime is the equivalent to cutting out people's tongues just on the off chance that they might falsely shout fire in a crowded theater.
Ouch. All right, Weird. Once again, you've caught him arguing in bad faith. It's good to see you. Talk to you again next week.
All right, see you later, Sean.
In addition to appearing here, Weird is a regular host on The Squirrel Report and blogs at weirdworld.com. That's W-E-E-R-D world.com. Stuff that grinds my gears. Well, the election's over.
The 2014 midterms.
And now I can finally tell some of these libertarians what I think of them.
Uh-oh.
In North Carolina, Tom Tillis won, and I want to specify that Tom Tillis is a turd. I don't want anyone to think that I believe Tom Tillis to be any less of a turd than he is. He is just slightly less of a turd than Kay Hagan, who he will replace. But Kay Hagan already screwed us over. Kay Hagan already voted for the Manchin Toomey thing, and she was perfectly willing, as far as we could tell, to vote for the version of it before Manchin Toomey, which was ridiculous. It was almost as bad as that monstrosity that they passed in Washington State. She was endorsed by Gabby Giffords' gun grab group, Americans for, what is it, Responsible Gun Safety, or Americans for Americans for Responsible Solutions. That's what she calls her gun grab group. Mm. And she was endorsed by the Demanding Mommies. So she had Bloomberg's backing.
Yeah.
So we're going to say, Tom Tillis, he's not good enough. Guess what, folks? This is a two-party system. It is by design. It works that way. There's not going to be a third party. The third party is not going to win. What's the last time there was a third party that was actually effective at anything other than blocking somebody else?
Probably pre-Civil War.
I think the last third party that ever got anywhere was called the Republican Party.
Yeah.
And guess what happened? We ended up shooting each other over this.
Well, that's true.
Who was the first Republican president?
That would be Lincoln.
Yeah, the one everybody started shooting at each other over.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's the last time a third party got anywhere in this country. And we went through that whole Reconstruction thing, and it really redefined how the Constitution worked, states versus federal government. So I really don't see it working anymore. My problem here with these libertarians is here in North Carolina, we had a bunch of people that said, Tom Tillis isn't good enough. I'm going to go vote for this moron who, I guess he's like a pizza delivery man. He's a serial runner for office in North Carolina. He's run for everything from governor to dog catcher, I think. If he handed out free beer at parties, they still think he wouldn't be voted, you know, most popular person at the party. He is a joke candidate. He's a joke candidate because he, you know, no matter what he stands for, he has a snowball's chance in hell of being elected to anything. Why would you vote for this person? You may as well just stay home. You know, at least that's honest. There are other people who are like, just vote for, you know, let's let it burn. Yeah. Oh, there's a good attitude. You know what happens when this system finally crashes? We're going to be shooting our neighbors, and we don't want to go that route. And it's not like they're going to say, we're going to starve politely and quietly while you sit there and have your food. No, they're going to come kick your door in and take your stuff. So you're going to get a choice. Either give them your stuff and starve, or they kill you, or shoot them. That's what happens when the system crashes. So anybody who says, just vote and let it burn, you're an idiot. Screw you. The people that want to sit out the election, they want to, I'm only going to vote for, you know, some crazy libertarian because I don't like this Tom Tillis character. Basically, what you're telling me is that you're lazy because there is no third party. There will not be a third party. The third party will get nowhere. So your options are take the people that you get or work to change one of the parties into what you want it to be. And if you're not willing to do the retail politics necessary in order to take over the party that you think is most likely to be receptive to your message, then what do you, you know, you're saying that you're lazy. You're not willing to do the work. You want to remain Olympian and above the problem and not dabble in this, you know, dirty politics stuff. Well, screw you. We have to deal with the real world consequences of that crap. You either get involved or shut up about it. Because I'm tired of hearing people, they're not good enough. Until they're perfect, you won't vote for them. What did Milton Friedman say about politicians? Milton Friedman said that, you know, everybody's acting like we should, you know, get perfect people. Vote for the right person. Get the right person in there. If we get the right person in there, they'll do the right thing. No, that's not how it works. You have to set up the circumstances so that the wrong people will do the right thing.
People have a great misconception in this way. They think the way you solve things is by electing the right people. It's nice to elect the right people, but that isn't the way you solve things. The way you solve things is by making it politically profitable for the wrong people to do the right things.
You have to make it painful for people to do things that you think are wrong. That's why I'm involved with Grassroots North Carolina, because Grassroots North Carolina makes it painful for people to do things that we don't like. It's hard work. It takes commitment. It takes being there every day. It takes sending stupid emails. It takes making phone calls. It takes going to the politicians' offices and sitting on their desk and making them listen to you and pounding them until they go the direction you want them to go. But throwing up your hands and saying, oh, I don't want to get involved in all that. I'll just vote for some third-party candidate who doesn't have a chance in hell of being elected to dog catcher is a cop-out, and I'm tired of it. And I'm telling you now, after the election, because I didn't want to be accused of, oh, you're just mad because your candidate lost. Well, you know, the person that I voted for won. People who voted for this other character didn't get in the way of that. So it's not sour grapes. This is just how I feel about it. Get involved. Push the politicians in the direction they need to go. And by God, they need to go that way. It's not like libertarianism is stupid. It makes sense. It's just that your refusal to participate in the actual politics that we deal with is foolish. I don't suppose there's anything pissing you off this week.
I'll just add to what you said. A great place to get involved is with your state level gun rights organization.
Yeah. The NRA is a completely another rant.
Yeah.
Why the NRA is annoyance on the state level is a completely separate rant. You need to get involved with your state group. GRNC in North Carolina. What is it in Tennessee?
It's the Tennessee Firearms Association in Tennessee. And I've actually, on my blog, gunscarstech.com, I have a list of all 50 states with the state-level organizations. I compiled that about 2 years ago.
We'll have that in the show notes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You need to get involved with those people.
Yeah.
Cut and dried, point blank, end of story. Those are the people you need to be involved with.
Yeah.
Because you live in a state. The laws that you will be prosecuted on are state laws. The people that write those laws live down the street from you, and they're more scared of you than anybody else on the planet because you can get a bunch of people together to vote their sorry behinds out of office. So they'll do what you tell them.
When I was involved with the TFA, I used to be a lot more involved than I am now because I have, you know, two kids now. It was pretty awesome to see legislators in the grocery store and they would recognize you and come up and talk to you. All you have to do is just go to their office and just talk to them. You'll have guys in your state-level organization that are very good. They're very, you know, they do it a lot. It'll usually be, you know, older retired guys who don't really have anything else to do. It's a very rewarding experience going and doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is a lot of fun to scare these people.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
They are terrified. Well, that's our show for the week. Thanks to Rob Allen for our music, and thank you for listening to the Gunblog Variety Cast. Constructive criticism can be sent to Sean at seansorrentino.com. And hate mail to WizardPC at GunsCarsTech.com. Show notes can be found at GunBlogVarietyCast.com/episode 12. We'll be right back.